Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders, where we learn about the bold path of building digital products that sell themselves. Let's listen to product leaders who can give us a glimpse into the innovative thinking process. Showcasing and celebrating these awesome folks, I'm your host, UX and product design veteran, Thomas Watkins. Welcome to Product-Led Growth Leaders. We have a really fascinating guest today, Wes Kuzmal. He was the founder of Delphi Corporation, a company that popularized the internet, according to author Michael Wolff. In 1981, he created the world's first digital online encyclopedia. Some of his early innovations served as a precursor for modern online social networks. In 1986, while serving as CEO of Delphi, Wes launched a spinoff project, Global Villages, Inc., that provided private label social networks to serve magazine publishers and other types of business clients with their own social networks. The focus was on reliability, reliable identities, individuals on the internet, and so forth. This started with a technology, the Vivos enrollment workstation. While developing Vivos, Wes began collecting source material for a book about a hypothetical world public key infrastructure built on digital certificates and representing measurable identities with the purpose of bringing authenticity to online interactions. So during this time, Wes was introduced to a group at the ITU, International Telecommunications Union, which was attempting the same idea, a world public key infrastructure. The ITU was spearheading the global cybersecurity agenda. Wes was appointed to the high-level experts group in an address in 2008 to the United Nations World Summit on Information Security, WSIS, in Geneva. Wes introduced the City of Osmio, which was a new certification authority. Wes's book publications include Quiet Enjoyment, published in 2004, with a second edition in 2014, Don't Get Nortled in 2013, and Escape the Plantation in 2014. Wes, thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Thomas. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So I guess one thing we could kind of dive right into is Delphi. Let some of maybe the users know about Delphi. Who is that? What kind of technology? Why was that significant back in the day?
Sure. Well, Delphi actually started out with the encyclopedia. Encyclopedia was launched in October of 81, and it turned out to be a horrible business. So this was the very time when parents were clamoring to get computer education for their kids, because, of course, the personal computer was the new thing. And all the classes were filled up, but they discovered that, hey, you know, they could subscribe to this encyclopedia, and we provided unlimited support. So basically, we pick up the phone first thing in the morning, and a few hours later, we're still doing computer education to their kids. So we stopped supplying the computer. We had started adding social features, bulletin boards, and of course, email and chat rooms and things. And so basically a year later, we were in the social media business and had dropped the encyclopedia was still part of it, but it was just a menu item as opposed to the thing. And that turned out to be a big success. We partnered with computer hobbyist magazines, and our competitors in those days were CompuServe and Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest was kind of hyper concerned about liability. So, for instance, only two people could be in a chat because, they were worried about people, slandering and libeling and things like that. They're an old consumer magazine publishing company that is dealing with new media. And so it's understandable. They were apprehensive about it, as all publishers were apprehensive about online media, with some reason. I've often wondered why these owners of reader and advertiser assets don't own Facebook, don't own Twitter. You know, I mean, it would only have been natural, but you got 5 hours, we can talk about it.
Well, so one question I do have is, in what way was it social media, right? Because people will listen to this and they'll say like the 1980s social media. And so, and I think that a lot of the stuff you're talking about is certainly a precursor to that. And there's a social aspect, but can you describe why it's helpful for us to think about it as sort of an early social media?
Sure. Well, I mean, it had all the features that you find in, you know, modern social media, except the graphics, because, you know, when we launched, the modem speed had gone from 110 BPS to 300 BPS, and then shortly after 1200 BPS. So if you're going to share images at those bit rates, be prepared to wait while that screen paints. You know, you could do it, but wasn't recommended. So it was all text. And, you know, you think, okay, well, the internet isn't that old. Well, it wasn't an internet thing. You know, interesting story about social media and the internet. The internet was originally a project of the NSF, National Science Foundation, and they adopted the same rules that ham radio operators had about commercial traffic. In other words, no commercial traffic allowed. You couldn't even say, hey, I've got an apartment to sublet here, you know, or I want to sell a puppy. It was not, you know, you could not do anything commercial. Then a couple of guys, Rick,
I got the name probably.
Phil Blampede, who was the creator of the TBBS bulletin board system, and Jack Rickard decided to do this end run around the NSF. And they said, well, we understand you can't carry commercial traffic on your backbone. So tell you what, we'll create an alternate background and just send anything with commercial content our way, and you take the non-commercial content. And the NSF said, well, how are we supposed to do that? How are you supposed to tell whether a message has commercial content? And their answer was, well, that's your problem. You know? So they said, oh, we give up. We basically, they just relinquished control of the internet and let basically universities, a wide variety of participants run the nodes of the internet. And that's when commercial traffic became okay. And we're talking about the early 90s, like 91 or so, just before we sold Delphi to Rupert Murdoch. So before that, I suspect this was your real question. How did it exist before the internet? And so there was an earlier protocol that nobody seems to recall, but it you know, existed for a decade. It was called the X25 protocol, and it was run by some private backbone operators, TimeNet and Telenet. Telenet was or became a unit of GTE. And they used this protocol called X25. And so you dial up a local phone number. In those days, long distance was costly. So you dial up a local phone number and it would connect you via a packet network as opposed to, you know, POTS, telephone lines. And also there were the networked BBS systems, and I mentioned TBBS was one of them, where just people would run a PC running these bulletin board systems, you know, in their home, and some of them were just standalone, but a lot of them were relayed, so you could connect to your local BBS, and that would in turn dial up another non-long distance BBS system, it was a little bit clunky, but fun. Anyway, That's social networks in the 80s was a totally different breed, but a lot of fun.
That's interesting history, Wes. Thanks for sharing that. And there's so many different parts that I want to poke at here, but so one that I guess we could talk about is the city of Osmio. What is that? And the one from the 2008 United Nations World Summit.
Sure. So that started out, you mentioned that as I was writing Quiet Enjoyment, some people from the ITU heard that I was writing this book about a network that my idea resembled what they were actually building. It was called the World eTrust Initiative. So I joined them in building the World eTrust Initiative. And then we had a big announcement in late 2004, early 2005. I don't remember exactly, but roll this wonderful thing out. You know, the ITU's vision was to provide a basis of trust for transactions among developing world people in the developing world, business people in the developing world. And I came along and said, hey, it's not just the developing world that need trust. You know, it's the developed world as well that serves everybody. And so anyway, we rolled it out to the member states of the ITU, about half of whom, or maybe some significant portion of them, had their own national certification authority, their own national PKI. And they immediately said, hey, wait a minute, are you saying that our national CA is going to be subordinate to this global thing? And the answer was, yeah. You know, how else are you going to do this? And I mean, this is the whole federated identity thing, you know. I mean, you know, everybody shares identity or trust information and supposedly adheres to the same standards. Well, good luck with that. So basically they said, their reaction was horror. They said, get this thing out of here, pull the plug right now. And so the two gentlemen, Alex Natoko and Hamadoun Touré, took me aside and said, we don't want to kill this thing. We don't want to see it die, but the member states set the ITU's agenda. We have no choice, but will you take it? And I said, yes, but I think it should be characterized as a municipality, a source of duly constituted public authority. And here's why, you know, as a computer thing, it's, you know, people can't get their head around it. If you model it as a source of authority, okay, then they think of it as a national or provincial government, you know, this whole decentralization concern. But if you call it a municipality, a city, city governments tend to be much more approachable than national or provincial governments. You don't have layers of bureaucracy and legislatures and complicated process for getting anything done. You can, because City Hall is right down the street, you know, you can go there and knock on the door of your city council person and get an audience and express your feelings about something. So, and of course, with an online City Hall, it's even more convenient. It's right there on your desktop or in your phone. So anyway, they initially were, I don't know, they weren't totally accepting of the idea, but they warmed up to it. And so on March 7, 2005, at the ITU's Geneva headquarters, we wrote the charter, municipal charter for the city of Osmio. And of course, the ITU is part of the UN, so Osmio inherits the duly constituted public authority of the United Nations. And I can demonstrate that it's important to me. You know, we're kind of at a point with decentralization where people are realizing, hey, the only thing that's truly decentralized is Bitcoin, and every other crypto universe has a set of rules and a set of people making the rules and managing the nodes. And so guess what? That's not decentralized. And as long as you recognize the need for a source of trust, basically an authority that attests to your identity claim and other claims, then you might as well do it right and have it global and duly constituted. So that's what Osmio is about.
Nice. Thank you for that history. Now, what is it that you are building today? Is it related to that, or is it something completely different?
I'm so glad you asked. It is everything we do is related to Osmio, because everything we do, we deliver real privacy, real security, and real accountability. And we also deliver accountable anonymity, or accountable anonymity. So we're promising people that they can assert their identity without disclosing their identity. How does that work? Well, think about your car's license plate. Anyone can see it, making you accountable for what happens on public roadways, but nobody gets to know the identity of the owner of the car unless there's been an incident or unless law enforcement thinks that you're transporting something illegal, in which case there is a mapping between your license plate and your driver's license. And that can be disclosed, but only with a court order, only with under a due process. So yes, everything we do relies upon this attestation from duly constituted public authority. And people are starting to realize that that's necessary. So getting around to an answer to your question, we are getting ready to launch a crowdfunding campaign to finish our development of what we're calling MOI, which stands for My Own Information, which is a personal information vault, which allows you to control the use, access to, and use of information about yourself. So all of your personal information is contained in this vault that you have control of. Now, you can license people to know certain things about yourself. So for instance, let's take an example. Let's say you need tires for your car, and you would like every vendor of tires to know that you're in the market, and you want them to know how many miles you drive per year. You probably want to share your VIN, your vehicle ID number, so they know the make and model and everything else. But only tire vendors, and they are not to use that information for any purpose other than knowing what kind of tires you need. And they, of course, will probably send you a deal and an offer of a set of tires. And once you've made your choice and you've purchased the tires, then you cut off access to that set of vendors called tire vendors. Same with your insurance company, only you probably want to keep that permission open for them as long as they're your insurer. So they have access to name and address and all. Information that will change from time to time. They're always updated. They always know, have access to information about yourself. Now, what happens if you're online and you start defrauding someone? Let's say you put up an imaginary laptop for sale on eBay, and somebody buys it and turns out it doesn't really exist. They need to find out who you are. They have a right and a need, and if they can get a court order, then you're, and I haven't talked about attestation officers yet, but they go present a court order to Osmio, and Osmio will forward that to the person who's responsible for your enrollment. We call it an attestation officer. And they can decide whether it's a legitimate court order. And if it is, then they will disclose your identity. But the good part about it is, let's say it's not a legitimate court order. Let's say you are a resident of a country with a totalitarian regime, and you've been publicly critical of the dictator. And the dictator comes knocking on Osmio's door and says, I need to know who this person is. Osmio doesn't even know. It's only your attestation officer who knows. So Osmio says, well, you know, you need a court order and we'll forward it to your attestation officer. And they, in turn, can look at the court order and say, no, this is a kangaroo court. We're not going to honor it. Forget it. Toss it in the trash. Or, yeah, it's legitimate. He's been defaming you and, you know, telling lies about you online. And you, it's legitimate. You need to know who it is. So anyway, it MOI, my own information, is about personal control, the use of personal information. It is personal. It turns your personal information into personal intellectual property protected by copyright law and secrecy law. So you issue the relying party the NDA and license, not the other way around.
Wes, this is so interesting. And one of the things that jumps out to me as you're talking about this is some of the value proposition reminds me of sort of the blockchain world, where there's this kind of like, oh, you'll have privacy. And I don't know if you are using blockchain in yours, but what jumps out to me is that it's not just value for the individual who doesn't want their identity. You know, society has some value in this too, because you could catch scammer, you know, with the setup that you just described. It's not just protecting the individual. Right. It's the society and the collective group that's chosen to be a part of this is also protected.
Exactly. So what we often say is we are all relying parties. You know, in IT speak, a relying party is your bank. You know, a relying party is Amazon or some big institution, but the individual isn't thought of as a relying party. Well, absolutely, we're all relying parties. We all rely on claims made by people we encounter online. You know, all these email, DMARC, et cetera, schemes for limiting, you know, calling anything from anyone you don't know spam. Well, no, you do encounter people that you haven't met before, and you may want to exchange information with them. You may want to communicate with them. They have something you're interested in. So the system can't be your judge as to who you want to communicate with. Instead, if in our spaces, you know, I mentioned a municipality that serves as the capital of an online continent called Authentiverse. Everybody in Authentiverse has an identity certificate. Everybody is accountable. Anything you do in Authentiverse, you're accountable for what you do, and others are accountable to you. And isn't that the way the world has worked for millennia? There are ways of making ourselves accountable. We have systems and methods of doing that have been developed over centuries. But all of a sudden, when we're talking about the digital universe, all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, we can't use anything from the old world. It doesn't apply. Well, that's absolutely wrong. So, for instance, our indoor spaces, if you go into a building in Authentiverse, it will have an occupancy permit. And that occupancy permit is digitally signed by an architect, contractor, and building inspector. So you know that it's secure, or if not, someone's livelihood is on the line. You're in a building right now. I'm in a building right now. We talk about the information highway. Well, what is a highway but an outdoor public transport system? And then we complain because it's got all these vulnerabilities. Well, what would you expect if you lived in a cardboard box by the side of a highway, lived, worked, and kept your files and let your kids hang out in a cardboard box by the side of a highway? Of course it's not secure, because highways are, that's the nature of roadways. But how do we typically use highways? We use highways typically to go from building to building. You know, nothing wrong in the outdoors, but it's suitable. It's suitable for some things and not for others. And you just don't have your meetings in a parking lot by the side of the highway, you know, in a rest area by the side of the highway. You have your meetings in a bounded space called a building. What is a building but a set of accountability spaces? You tend to know who's in a room with you. And that's the purpose of a building besides giving you a nice climate, you know, and keeping the rain off your head.
Right. So Wes, this is so much interesting stuff. And before we wrap up, I need to pick your brain about your insights on technology, where technology is going, given that you have such a deep history in technology. Of the modern developments, do you have any kinds of insights or ideas that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think we're headed for a cliff or going to hit the wall or whatever metaphor you want to use. As long as we throw up our hands and say, oh, deep fakes. You deep fakes, anybody can alter anything and claim that, you know, Joe Biden said this or, you know. And like, wait a minute, no, there's this thing called a digital signature. You can sign anything. You can sign a document. You can sign an image. You can digitally sign a video. And that says that I, the signer, take responsibility for what's in that video. If anything's been altered, here I am. I'm responsible. And you can even use the principle of professional licensing for that. And say that not only am I responsible for that video being as recorded, but if it turns out that I'm pulling a fast one and I'm actually digitally signing altered content and I don't identify the altered content, I can lose my livelihood. And oh, by the way, professional licensees tend to be well compensated, right? I think a professionally licensed code signer, for instance, should have a seven-figure income. I think a lot of these digital professional licensees should have seven-figure incomes. Why? Because they're going to be very careful, right? They're going to know what they sign. They're going to be very diligent about signing things because if they get caught, or they're lazy and they sign something they shouldn't have, there goes that seven-figure income. And that's the way it works in architecture. You know, if I'm going to sign that occupancy permit, your building can't be occupied unless I sign it. Well, guess what? That gives the architect a lot of leverage, and that leverage turns into generous incomes for those architects who get the gigs. So where was I? We're headed for the cliff if we continue to ignore the fact that these systems of accountability are well established in decades past and centuries back. Even PKI itself, asymmetric cryptography, is decades old. It's old stuff. You know, we bring some new stuff to the party, but not that much. Most of it's based on just old principles and old technology.
Technology is old, but the innovation is new.
Saying, wait a minute, you know, bringing occupancy permits and professional licensing to it is a, you know, that's a new idea. I'm constantly surprised that it's a new idea because to me it's obvious, you know. But anyway, yes.
Yeah.
Unless we bring in systems of accountability, you know, things are going to go from bad to worse.
Wes, where can people find out more about you and the projects that you're working on?
I think a great place to start is authentiverse.net and go all the way through to it to what's called the Authentiverse Visitor Center. And there's some, you know, there's some things on the wall that you'll see there, some possibilities. But we'll, you know, you can sign up for our newsletters and email lists. So authentiverse.net.
I love it. Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Wes Kuzmal. And I hope people find out more about you and your work. Thank you so much for being on today's show.
It's my pleasure, Thomas.
Thank you for tuning in. Join us next time on Product-Led Growth Leaders. Take care.